Welcome to They Did It, your official source for information on conspiracies, bizarre beliefs, and the unexplained, with your hosts, Brian Bonner and Jack Hanley. Jack is a historian and folklorist, whose academic milieus include Central and Eastern European history, modern European history, European and American folklorists, and contemporary urban folklore. Brian has investigated paranormal claims for over 20 years and is trained in many related fields, including psychology, electronics, influence and deception detection, hypnosis, and audio analysis. He leads talks and lectures on critical thinking, paranormal investigations, historical research, digital imaging, and supernatural claims analysis. Continue at your own risk. Take us down the rabbit hole, boys.
Welcome, fellow travelers. As conspiracy theory popularity goes, one year proved a particularly troublesome one for America. The race for the presidency was turning ugly, and bizarre theories surrounding a new world order began to emerge. Then there were the rumors of European elite societies secretly plotting the overthrow of the US government from abroad. The local churches were abuzz with hearsay that Christianity itself was under attack by forces, at least nefarious, if not literally satanic. A mysterious group of radicals from Germany, known as the Illuminati, were purported to have their subversive tentacles in seemingly every facet of the American cultural and political landscape. Washington was abuzz with fear, and wild stories seemed to emanate from every corner of the political landscape, all the way up to the White House itself. What year, you ask, served as this pinnacle of governmental conspiracy theories? 2020? 2024? The year was 1800, and America was proving that its love of governmental conspiracy was not only flourishing, but seemingly here to stay. In fact, you could say the conspiracy surrounding the U.S. government is, well, as old as the U.S. itself. And if our current media scuttlebutt is any indication, just as strong as ever. Join us on this episode as we examine the long and twisted history of American governmental conspiracy theories here on the They Did It podcast. Welcome, fellow travelers, to Season 2 of They Did It, a conspiracy podcast. We are back from a short break and back by popular demand for Season 2, because, sadly, misinformation never sleeps. But thankfully, dear listeners, neither do your intrepid hosts, who have returned to the studio from a sabbatical to go down all those rabbit holes so that you don't have to. I am your co-host, Jack Hanley, and with me, as always, is my conspiratorial partner in crime, Brian Bonner. Welcome, my friend.
How's it going?
Oh, it is so good to be back in the studio with you.
It is good to be back. And like you said, the crazy never sleeps. I believe it's actually a little more awake than it was the last time we were here. Things are just getting crazier.
They keep pulling us back in. Every time we want to take a break, my friend, we get pulled back in. And speaking of breaks, for our listeners that don't know, because it always sounds like when we say sabbatical, it almost comes across like we just don't see each other for a short spell, which is entirely not true. We sabbaticaled together on many things and many projects. So let's tell the listeners a little bit outside of all things conspiratorial. What were we doing on our break?
You say break like it was. Let's
on our work outing.
on the Rocky Mountain paranormal side of things.
Yes.
we had many a lecture. So presentations were up. And our big deal of the year was the release of our first book, The Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society, Volume 1. Yes, there will be more.
And it's fantastic, listeners.
Which is actually kind of trending out there. So
I was going to say, what is the big news that we just discovered today about this?
Well, yeah, I just discovered that it's on the top 15 or 16 of the CNN. I'm trying to remember who the other one was, but it's the CNN must read paranormal book of the year.
That is congratulations. Okay. Bravo. And we will, of course, talk about this on the site, and we encourage our listeners to go check this out. It is a masterful book. Part of me, it's a little bit of a cheat too for me, because, you know, a lot of the cases that are described here are things I've known about, being your longtime friend and a collaborator and partner in crime for years. So I am just so happy that this is out. Another thing our listeners may not know is that we also take time off during that that festive holiday season, basically starting from October into November, for us to be attending many of our conferences and festivals related to horror, which is a subsidiary passion of ours, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's some of the talks that I was discussing. We had the Colorado Festival of Horror. We had,
yes,
Rocky Mountain Nightmares. We had, I mean, there's just a whole laundry list of all of them. I think we hadn't even done Fan Expo the last time that we talked. So
right. It's incredible with all just the lectures that you and your partner there, Bob, do, and a friend of the show, Bob, and Carol, and go around and put on. But for our listeners that just only know us from our raving and ranting against conspiracies, they might not also be aware that we are avid and passionate horror cinephiles, and we have a lot of side projects. Like you said, a Colorado Festival of Horror is one of them. We also did some reporting back from Telluride Horror Show. So we're engaged in all things horror films, but also just film in general. I also I've been teaching a course over at the Dairy Art Center in Boulder on how to watch a movie, where I had as one of my most popular special guests, one Brian Bonner, for another one of the classes there. So even though we are off the air for a bit, we are together more than ever. So it isn't like I can say it's good to hear your voice again, because we hear each other all the time.
That's true.
But it's nice to be here.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Nice. Well, and nice on some level too, because the business at hand sometimes of why we do this podcast is not so great, but, so let's jump into that. As we're back, as we said, for our folks, back from that break period, so you can look forward to much more regularity with our podcast. We are excited about our whole second season of amazing podcast topics here within the realm of conspiracy theory. So, Brian, what is the topic that we are doing for this one? And I know it can come off a bit broad. This may well being just a part one of a very large segment here that we're biting off. But what is it that we're going to be talking about this episode?
Well, you know, the more that I looked into this, the more I realized that this is not only its own subject, but almost a recap of the entire last season.
Yes, yes.
because conspiracies run deep in everyone. But right now, and picking no sides, because both are just as guilty, the amazing beliefs and conspiracies that have started inside the political world.
Yes. So kind of a history of government conspiracy, as it were. And I'm almost going to preemptively just label this a part one, because folks that also our listeners may not know, that in addition to just seeing each other all the time, just hanging out for fun all the time, in our preparation for each of these episodes, we are continuously speaking on the phone, late night texting each other links and fun things that we've uncovered during our research sessions. And yeah, it just, you know, this one, it just seems like we realized this could be several shows. This could be an entire season just dedicated on this subject, had we wanted to.
It could be. My hardest part, and I swear I'm going to keep to it, is is not naming names, not naming parties, just saying these are currently popular in the in the field.
Sure, sure. And you know, we'll kind of follow our traditional format that we have to. On occasion, there are one or two where for me, and I really respect what you're saying there, because yeah, there's an equal opportunity of conspiracy here on both sides. My approach to honoring the spirit of that too was toward the end of the podcast, we always like to delve into some very specific ones that are very hot. We call that, I don't know, we should have that portion sponsored by like Snopes, right? And just have it like the hot conspiracies. But talking about some of the big ones within this framework, within this subgenre of conspiracy, and some that were, you know, levied against both. So for my two, I'm going to name two particular names, but from different political parties, and just try to show how being on either side of the aisle doesn't necessarily protect you, right, from these allegations of conspiracy.
Absolutely.
So, all right, well then, you know, yeah, let's kind of get started on here. So, what would you say is a good opener? And I always turn this over to you, Brian, like from the conspiracy side of things, for kind of like the modern state of government conspiracy kind of right now. I mean, we're going to jump a little bit into like the history and timeline coming up, but what's going on right now with this topic?
As with most conspiracies, just kind of a rebuilding of the old conspiracies with newer people. And I mean, that sounds strange, but that's kind of how conspiracies work anyways. They go through this cycle of they're really popular. They kind of fall out because people realize they may not be real. And then they get recycled years or decades later. And we're definitely watching those happen over and over.
God, are we ever? And sadly so. And real quick too, as you're kind of going in this, let me just interject too for our listeners, you know, kind of as we're trying to rein this in, this huge topic, we're kind of just doing a focus for this particular podcast on just American governmental conspiracy theories, right? Because as a genre, as long as there have been systems of government, you know this, however rudimentary, like dating back to the rise of city states and, you know, early civilization. So we're talking about over 5,000 years, there have been conspiracies surrounding those who held power, who sought power, who fight against each other to control the systems of power. So, right, this is an immense topic if we just talk about how conspiracies run in every governmental aspect throughout all of civilization, the history, and modern geopolitics. We're going to focus and just try to constrain it a bit just on the development among American governmental conspiracy theories.
I agree, but at the same time, we have this this thing of, even though it's a maybe what we would consider to be American belief, these conspiracies are spread so wide that a lot of them, they're worldwide.
Oh, absolutely, right? Yeah, and recycled from older, more historically relevant time periods, right, of geopolitics. So, well, absolutely, absolutely.
But I guess we should take a dive into the historical side of it.
Yeah, yeah. I love that about, and again, for if you're just joining us as a listener to this podcast, and we really are happy that you're here and welcome you if you are. Those that listen to us a lot and endure us know that I think what sets us apart from any other, and I'm going to say this proudly, sets us apart from any other podcast within this genre, is that we don't just examine and lay out the conspiracy theory or just try to bring on any sort of rebuttal, but we take pride that we also like to examine the historical context for why and how they might evolve, and then also look at the scientific application of why we may have evolved as humans and as societies to be primed to accept some of these theories. So yeah, kind of starting for them. I mean, let's just go basic from a historical perspective. I think Brian, and we talk about this all the time off microphone, it's a kind of important to remember that the perfect storm for like any societal conspiracy theory is any time within a framework of politics or social constructions where there's a perceived threat to your institution by another group that might be politically different, socially different, culturally different, ethnically different, racially different. You get the picture, right? And that's been from the dawn of the formation of just of our government under the auspices of, you know, European colonialization. And so historically, as America formed, our obvious first threat, ironically enough, as it came about, the object of one of our first focus on conspiracy theories centered around indigenous peoples as the threats, right? The original other of our original, formation of our nation. And some of the ones that I found intriguing that I know we've discussed is they included one in the belief that there was a centralized head chieftain figure that controlled all the indigenous tribes and coordinated attacks to root Europeans out. That was one of the earliest ones that we have recorded in American history. And even one alluding to the actual control of the Native Americans by the literal devil himself. Again, not surprising for anyone that's listened to our first season, right? So, and I'm gonna refer to you here because you said this exactly right, as we've always discovered. We love to talk about how this podcast has proven to us that most conspiracies, almost all of them, inherently have two universal truths. Firstly, they are mainly all rooted in ideas that are very old and very cyclical. There's nothing new under the sun in terms of conspiracy. We just recycle old ones to a modern context. But also, there are rarely any new conspiracy theories out there. They're just reiterations of older ones. But you can nearly always bet that when they exist, you can place good old-fashioned racism and xenophobia as a primary driver, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that, and I have to preface this by saying, no, I don't believe in most of these, but if you start investigating any of these, you'll find out all of them usually, not always, but usually start with some sort of a grain of truth, which when somebody who wants to believe or is a believer starts investigating it, it only reinforces the fact that whatever it is that they're believing is true.
Sure, sure. No, I think that's absolutely right. And so, I mean,
well, and I think government especially, because governments, I'll even stick just in the U.S., have done some pretty terrible things and covered them up. So, yeah, there's a lot of conspiracies out there that are true. So it gives them the basis of believing, well, if they did that, of course they'd do something else.
I love that you pointed that out, right? Because, I think sometimes from let's say, our side of the skepticism aisle, it can be very easy just to completely write off conspiracy theories in general, right? Or even like the kernel of truth that they may have emanated from as being, you know, ridiculous or absurd. But no, you're exactly right, right? The more we uncover over time, we realize how many times some pretty nefarious things have been done in the name of nationalism and our country and colonialism and the American dream, that certainly act as a serviceable point of attack, as an early reference to, as you just said it perfectly, well, this was in existence. Why is it such a leap that now this would be talked about?
Exactly. And, you know, unfortunately, when you're trying to debate somebody that is completely, you know, bought into a conspiracy, that's a hard argument to fight.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and especially as we discover more things all the time, too. And, you know, and even and in some of these cases that we are in, we'll kind of like delve into some later, specifically like when we discuss, let's say, like the FEMA concentration camp conspiracy theory, you know, not only rooted in some actual real historical event, you know, we had internment camps. These are real things we have done before. You, as you said, you know, it's there's not like there wasn't a precedent for this, but even sometimes just a hastily drawn up plan that certain government agencies or political parties, you know, or presidents themselves kind of like start constructing, or at least just like, you know, brainstorming about, once they are referenced to part of the historical record, those inevitably are also then brought out to demonstrate proof that there has to be a germination of truth emanating from these events, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, then you have to not only do that, but then you have to see where they're being spread like they are, because of the typical, not anything specific to this topic, but the conspiracy in general, is people, once they start believing, have that special knowledge that they have to share with other people, and it really makes them feel special. So it just,
oh, so true.
Wildfire.
Exactly right. Exactly. And the thing that, you know, we'll probably wind up touching on later is we're going to look at some of these historical time frames. And yes, while conspiracy has always been a part of the American experience, of the world's experience, and particularly within government, we really have now the means of transmission through the internet to be able to have them spread and be transmissible in a completely different way that we really can't rear back anymore, right? At least in prior ones. So let's even take this. If we're just looking at American political conspiracy theories, you know, there's been plenty out there, and we'll go over a few coming up here, like all throughout history. But I would argue that maybe some people would contend at least that like the Kennedy assassination becomes one of the big watershed major governmental conspiracy moments. But in a pre-internet age, you know, there were still at least some areas, you know, with inquiries and, you know, and commissions and governmental examinations and things like that, where journalism, you know, a vanguard of journalism also still helped contain on some level how this was framed as a national narrative. Whereas the second big watershed moment, I would contend maybe is like the next big one is 9/11, which is fully within the internet era. Look at how that took off and how trying to refute it from a scientific or rational or skeptical, you know, position is almost impossible.
Absolutely. And it kind of goes to that, the major reinforcement because of the, you know, yes, there have been cover-ups in the past, and people at that point in time, the general paranoia about government was really starting to increase right at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a genie that is certainly out of the bottle now, and we'll go into specifically within our current, political zeitgeist why that can never be bottled back in. But just to, I guess, so to wrap up on what we were talking about earlier for, yes, so, thematically, the American historical timeline of conspiracy is almost without exception, I would argue, kind of from a historical, you know, perspective, kind of framed within the dichotomy of our own construction of us, the U.S., us versus the other, right? Like how our nation was forged, how we colonized, how we took, how we controlled, and then therefore we're always in opposition with someone else, right? There's always been a historical precedent for a they to oppose us, as in our title that, you know, you created for us, that they did it, right? Who are the they? Well, America, by our nature of how we conquered and controlled and colonized, we always have had kind of like an inherent they to blame something on, right? In our contesting for the land itself. So very quickly for our listeners and you, Brian, here's some of the original timeline of just bullet points of some of the American historical theys that have been out there doing it. As we talked about, the indigenous population, next Catholics and Popish plots, then slaves, then Freemasons, anti-Masons, then freed slaves, then Asians, first wave immigrants, second wave immigrants, communists abroad, communists at home, Muslims, migrants, Mexican, you get it, right? It's like this has always been the historical timeline for this of the othering.
It is, but at the same time, in listening to your list there, kind of like I was saying earlier, they're making a repeat visit to us on a lot of them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and again, let's even take like what's probably the most oft-cited of the governmental conspiracies, which has been around for a long time, but it always rears its head. It's more popular now than ever, perhaps the most popular by Pew public opinion polls, and that is the New World Order, where we have a cabal of powerful elites and bankers and internationalists hell-bent on world domination, which we all know is just a dog whistle code for, you know.
Well, not just that, but now they've added to it.
Right, right. It evolves, sadly.
And now we have adrenochrome thrown into the mix.
Our very first episode. We were so young and innocent then, Brian.
Exactly.
We were so innocent before adrenochrome.
You know, the interesting thing about the whole adrenochrome thing was I personally had thought it had died down until I started diving into some of this stuff recently. It is just as popular as ever.
I know. It's shocking. It's terrible.
But not only is it as popular as ever, it has worked its way into the political field. So there are politicians out there spreading the whole, I mean, adrenochrome and underground, you know, child trafficking and all of this. Not that that doesn't exist, but not the way that they represent it.
Right. Well, moving into our thinkers. So, okay, we understand, like, historically, this has always been kind of like inherent in our national DNA. So let's kind of look at into that next thing we always examine next too, which is, okay, so we get that it exists. Why maybe are Americans in particular, what is unique maybe about us, or maybe not so unique as one might argue, why are we primed to believe this specifically about government? What are some things that you found in your research or that you bring to the conversation, given your long history with conspiracy? Let me turn to you about why we are so distrustful of the government.
I'm not sure that it's actually just us. I think government mistrust across the board is very popular, but because we have, especially over the past, you know, few decades, very polarized parties that are, you know, they'll throw each other in front of a bus at any turn, will add to the distrust, because the people themselves will say, don't trust the other people.
That's so true, and especially when you have this ridiculous, you know, dichotomy of just this two-party system that people, you know, will basically make the argument seem to just be operating as an oligarchy in their own way anyway, right? So yeah, I think that really adds to that if these are the only two options we have, and both seem to be consistently trying to assassinate each other politically, who are we to trust, right? There's just a real lack of any one that we can turn to from a governmental security standpoint.
Exactly. And I mean, regardless of which side you're with, that side will tell you the terrible things the other side is doing. And, you know, the other, there we go again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, that's just part of the political system. So I think no matter what we do, there's always going to be that distrust. Plus the fact, you know, like I was saying, historically, the government hasn't been the most forward group in the world.
Sure. I'm with you. And, you know, not only that, like, we're only just talking right now about the obvious inherent tendency to blame the external other. But even in times of relative peace, and by the way, we're a nation that out of like, what, of our 278 years of existence has had like maybe 15 to 18 years of peace within that time. So saying that tongue in cheekly, but even in like times, let's say, of where we try to convince ourselves that we're, you know, Pax Americana, we're in a peaceful moment, we will then look for internal others to confront within this theory, right? Like, it's built in to our construct. So, you know, we start developing irrational anxieties of, okay, if we don't have a very personified external power, then who are the powers from within who are trying to destroy our culture and way of life?
Well, and I think it falls back to that need to have some sort of special knowledge, and that really makes people excited because they feel like they're protecting people. And the minute that comes into play, it makes it spread like wildfire because, I mean, inherently people want to protect their fellow person.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I think what's also kind of, I love that is a big point, because, and I want to jump a little bit further into that, because this idea too that of, you know, feeling a sense of power from this, the idea that you are in, you know, through the transmission of special knowledge that other people can't possess or do not know, how that empowerment that it has, right? For that to be a motivating factor, then inherently we have to, right, realize that then conspiracy theories, we can argue, exist because of frustration and political or personal disenfranchisement within our country. Like, that is a correlating factor, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the way that it's being spread now it's kind of interesting because we have things like Q, see one of our previous episodes, that kind of combines different conspiracies that I don't think had ever even, you know, nobody'd even thought about combining these. But it's given a way to take all of these, you know, weird beliefs and kind of compile them into one belief system.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You're right. You're right. And, you know, it's funny, too, we bring that, too, because we've talked about this. Funnily enough, we actually were doing, we did a talk at Colorado Festival of Horror one time about looking at how, like, just different movements with our career. We were kind of examining the history of the hotel as a construct within horror films throughout each you know, decade, if you'll recall. And whenever we talked about, like, post 9/11 horror, right, we were really examining also how there is such a correlation between, like, social, political, or economic anxiety during a specific time period, and then how we internalize them or externalize them too into our popular culture, and in this case, our conspiracy theories, as, like, the boogeyman, right, that's out there for it. And so I think that's also fascinating too, right? Because it's as the more our country is in anxiety, the more we see a new flourishing of new conspiracy theories, people prone to believe them, greater transmission. But even within our popular culture, we see more religious films, right? We see more religious horror films.
Well, and, you know, not to knock religion, but a lot of these conspiracies fall back on very big religious beliefs.
That's right. And you know, and we get that, right? If the goal is to assuage anxiety and fear, then that's and you know, you've got someone out there selling the antidote that someone is in control. You know, if you don't believe that your government or your president or the country's in control, then you can at least believe that there is a deity that has a master plan, right? Yeah, that I can see where that leap for why one would go there.
Well, and not just for reasons of that, but I'll hop off into one that we've never really covered to an extreme, but the Flat Earth conspiracy, if you dive into it rather deeply, you'll discover that a lot of its belief is based on religious belief.
Yeah, that's right. And if
you take that out from under a lot of these different conspiracies, they fall apart.
That's absolutely so true. You know, and it, again, just, you know, it's talking with just again, but like spaces of anxiety, moments and eras of anxiety within, you know, geopolitic and world history that affect this. I came across this amazing quote by civil liberties lawyer, Frank Donner. And he specifically mentioned about conspiracy and why we're prone to it, that quote, especially in times of stress, exaggerated, febrile explanations of unwelcome reality, a beautiful term, by the way, Brian, better than we're saying it, explanations of unwelcome reality come to the surface of American life and attract support. These new conspiratorial movements illuminate a striking contrast between our claims of superiority, indeed our mission as a redeemer nation to bring a new world order, and the extraordinary fragility of our confidence in our own institutions.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is just a gorgeous coming. That may be a bit too long for the t-shirt in our store that's upcoming, but I love it.
There's never too long of a slogan.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, like, the final ones in this, before we go into some of our specific ones examining that, I think also we're just also in a moment here just of, you know, post-boomer kind of like late-stage capitalism where we have anxiety also about class systems and over lack of real financial, economic, or political power, right? So this lack of control is, of course, you know, correlated with, you know, it is proven that the less we feel in control of our lives, our employment, our education, our status, our power, our political power, that we try to find a psychologically soothing explanation.
Absolutely.
So I think it's just, yeah, we're in a real perfect storm right now. Oh, and then lastly, as we talked about too, before we go into it, is also now conspiracy used and wielded as a political weapon, which I think you've made that point so perfectly. I would, you know, this has always existed. Like, on one level, I don't want from a historical perspective to make people think that some of this, like this insane dichotomy, like when people claim we've never been more at odds with each other. Well, we kind of always have historically. We've hit each other with canes on the Senate floor before, you know. We've had physical violence before.
I think that's something that really does need to be pointed out is the fact that even though it seems like things are much worse than they've ever been. It's always seemed like things were much worse than they've ever been. Right. That's part of the game.
Oh God, yes. So, but I think you're absolutely on to something, and hopefully this will be a paper you'll work on at some point, specifically about though how, like, just because, you know, the inherent nature of a two-party system, that full black and white dichotomy, us, them, good, evil, right, wrong, really lends itself now that conspiracy is becoming the most, perhaps sadly, effective way, right, within a political fight to destroy your opponent now. Where right. maybe that's a little bit more of an evolution than we've seen in the past. Of, you know, we've seen in the case of political campaigns famously where, you know, conspiracy was wielded that may have shaped an election. But we right now are in the midst of a national turmoil where conspiracy is challenging elections in the democratic process.
Absolutely.
So that's yeah, I do think we're kind of in a weird time, and maybe it's, and which is why we do this podcast too, right? It's more than ever, I think it's needed that we examine these things, talk about them, and offer a solution. So one of the final components we always do for every podcast is we like to look at some individual ones. We talked for the forest. Let's go into the trees and talk some. And I found a list from a recent Pew Research poll, which talked about the top. It was a countdown of the top American governmental conspiracy theories out there. And was also adorable. They also tied it with a study done with Teen Vogue to always see what the young generation feels about government and conspiracy, which I think is fascinating as a subset. And so they compiled a list. And for our listeners, we're going to exclude, when we kind of just wanted to narrow down a couple here to talk about with you, we're excluding those that we've already done full episodes on. So, as we mentioned, Adrenochrome and Pizzagate and false flags and vaccines. It breaks my heart to see all these topics that we've done episodes on already, vaccinations. So we urge you, if you're new or if you just haven't, you know, heard some in a while, go back and revisit those original, that original season and our original project that we came up with, some of our topics. So we're excluding those here. And there are some others that were on the list that we know full well we plan on doing full episodes on. And readers, let me tell you something. When Brian and I first met over copious amounts of alcohol at his house, hanging out, first kind of pitching the idea to each other about how we wanted to proceed. If you'll remember, Brian, we started making this list that grew throughout the night, along with our anxiety, I would proffer, of all the topics we were going to be doing episodes on.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even with this one, like I say, it was kind of like, okay, I've got to revisit all these things that I've already covered before. It's really interesting. But at the same time, the fact that it's still spreading like it is.
So,
talked about this a year ago, but it's still now going stronger than ever.
And again, so folks, there's more to come. There will be a part two, I think, of this, or even a part three. And some of these specific ones, if you're like, hey, my favorite conspiracy from the government wasn't touched on, there'll probably be an actual full episode on that one coming up. So let's look at three just kind of ones that broach the top 10, but and have, they're a bit more recent. They're in the top 10, but that fall outside those categories. So Brian, let's talk number one about the death panel conspiracy theory.
I believe that was an episode of Star Trek. I mean, it that whole concept really does fall back to some sci-fi.
Yeah.
Because the only place that really does happen is in times of extreme mass casualties, such as war or a natural disaster, where you do have to pick and choose who's going to live and who's going to die based on their condition.
Right, right. Yes, in an extreme triage, right, decision-making process in a national emergency. But for this purpose of where it came and adhering to kind of what we laid the groundwork to do to stick to the rules, we can just probably say safely that phrase really got thrust into the national zeitgeist during the 2009 presidential debate, vice presidential debate about federal healthcare legislation and reform, right? As specifically intended by the party in power to try to, you know, help cover the uninsured in the United States. It was brought about specifically referenced and checked, name checked by a former governor of a state up north, let's say. And it was coined the term in the debates whenever they said that this legislation specifically from Bill H.R. 3200, that this legislation was proposing an actual death panel of government entities and powerful bureaucrats who would make literal decisions on whether your grandma or any other elderly person or sick person or disabled American would be worthy of medical care and therefore could withhold it, which, as you pointed out, is also just a ludicrous assertion, of course, because there's nothing mentioned in any proposed legislation of any kind that ever existed for that. But that's kind of where it first got thrown into the zeitgeist.
Exactly. And, you know, during the pandemic, when there was some issues with hospitalizations, they kind of had that situation going. But once again, that was an extreme situation.
Right, right. And well, and, you know, talk about just like the origins of just like, I would argue with this one, too. This is just very like political, nefarious political crafting there. Because I think one person, because she's not necessarily like part of a party there, but weirdly enough, we all assign this to one particular one person for kind of getting this started. But it was actually kind of cribbed from a weirdly more nefarious and kind of interesting background when I kind of went down the rabbit hole of it, where it was a woman by the name of Betsy McCaughey Ross, who's a historian, former lieutenant governor of New York. And I can mention her name despite our original plan because she was both running as a Democrat and Republican and later on Liberty Party member. So just this person, later economic advisor under the Trump administration and a fellow of a couple conservative think tanks. But she was a longtime opponent just in general of federal healthcare legislation and kind of like dedicated her life's focus to attacking any type of American healthcare reform policy, no matter who was in power, whenever it came, right? And it kind of was launched in this famous piece called No Exit in 1994 in the New Republic, but which is, funnily enough, Brian, I discovered also co-written openly by Philip Morris Agency, so there you go, which kind of single-handedly sunk the first iteration of health reform plan by, you know, basically asserting a lot of hyperbole of, you know, falsely extrapolating what was very specifically it was a wanting and a referring to of the section of the bill which wanted providing voluntary counseling to Medicare patients about their options regarding living wills, advanced directives, and end-of-life care options, which is something that's done in every other nation's healthcare system. That one phrasing was then used and wielded politically, as we brought up before, to the death panel, which also then has like, you know, Nazi extermination camp allusions to it, right? Exactly. So there's a really disgusting political ploy here. But it was so effective that later on in 2009, the Daily Beast called Betsy McConaughey Ross, quote, an article piece on her called "The Woman Who Single-Handedly Killed Healthcare in America." So pretty effective. I mean, this is one that a lot of folks really believed, even across different parties, right? That, and again, this kind of goes to what I love was your original goal for this episode, which is this crosses both sides of the aisle. This, I think, had a 30 to 35%, you know, a belief acknowledgement on a Pew poll, which is horrifying.
Well, and, you know, unfortunately, a lot of this seems to be headed that way.
Yeah, it's, you know, and even though this kind of like had its own place in the historical place in history, and I, you know, there's even been films made about it. You can kind of watch about like this one moment in the American, you know, political zeitgeist there. Actually, there is a New York congressional candidate who I will not name and later U.S. representative who once very famously said in 2018, actually, we have for-profit death panels now. They're basically companies and insurance board saying you're on your own because we choose not to cover a critical procedure or medicine, right? So like, in a weird way, it's like you could wield that against a lot of different organizations of for-profit healthcare in this country.
Exactly.
So jumping forward, the second most popular, the good old FEMA concentration camp conspiracy theory.
Well, and I think you kind of touched on it because we've got that historical memory of the fact that we had camps here.
That's right.
And there are still many people around who remember them, who were in them.
That's right. A very famous one mentioning Star Trek.
Exactly. I was going to say Mr. Takei himself talks about that very often.
He's been a real advocate for not allowing that portion of American history to fall into disrepute. So yeah, very important. So that's right. For those listeners, maybe let's say you're one of the few out there who didn't even hear it. But let's say what we're talking about here is, of course, it's a widely held belief. And this is one a lot of with some militia and patriot movements in the United States, anti-government movements, that the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is actively planning and preparing to imprison swaths of U.S. citizens in what would basically be concentration camps, either for re-education purposes, which is just cribbed right out of Red Dawn, or following the imposition of martial law in the United States after a natural disaster or crisis. So in some versions of this, it's dissidents that will first be imprisoned. In large extreme versions, it's a means of population control from the New World Order. So this one goes pretty wide.
Well, it does. And, watching how these conspiracies have grown, especially looking at people who believe it, all of a sudden we have underground tunnel systems. Every closed business, every closed supermarket is now all of a sudden going to become this camp in the middle of the city that nobody knows about, but we're going to be able to, use it. In fact, back to one of our previous episodes, supposedly underneath DIA.
That's right. Our own episode on the Denver International Airport somehow ties to this FEMA concentration camp theory as well.
Exactly. If there's a large open space or a questionable tunnel, there's somebody going to say it's part of that.
And I mean, talk about like a bipartisan attempt of like just a government agency. It's like this was like first established in like late 70s under the Carter administration, codified into law under the Bush administration, right? And later, and Department of Homeland Security. This is a bipartisan attempt to just try to say, yes, we need a section of government, a department that can coordinate a well-coordinated response to major disasters in our country that happen to overwhelm our local and state authorities. Really, that simple. And what it then has spun off to is just fascinating and horrifying simultaneously. And this one, what I found weird about this one, too, is that it has these just like creepy original origins there. I don't know if in your research you also came across one of these early 1960s, kind of like a Christian, going back again, Christian nationalist movements called the, the Latin name comes from like Force of the Country. It was kind of a loosely organized Christian nationalist movement, but kind of, tied together our old golden oldies again of, anti-government, anti-Semitic, white supremacy movements believe that it's a conspiracy by the United States government that all these passages of this legislation in these camps and FEMA itself mainly to attack the political rights of white Christians. But this wound up going weirdly mainstream, like the National Review used to use it in their fundraising emails and letters. Congresswoman, various congresspeople were dropping this on a national level. There were even animal liberation movements, which are often much more associated on the left, that were citing this as happening. And then, of course, our old pal Alex Jones, drinking game for you listeners out there, brought this up. So, yeah, I mean, this is like, it's just crazy how this went mainstream. But you said it perfectly here, too, again. Yeah, and mainly it's always cited, yes, the internment of the Japanese Americans during World War II, which we know at least it has some historic precedent, right, that it's happened. But one of the other ones I came across, too, and I think I sent you a text about, was a contingency plan called Rex 84,
right,
which was drafted at that time. Again, preliminary, ideology and drafting. It's fanciful. It's psychotic. But by Oliver North, calling for the suspension of the Constitution and detaining of citizens in the event of a national crisis, which at that time, what's funny is this is wielded a lot by those on the right side of the aisle claiming that they're the ones who are going to be persecuted. That iteration of that contingency plan was drafted actually aimed at left-wing activists. You know, not libertarians are on the right. So yeah, it's fascinating how this one has continued to spread. And then with COVID came out again.
Well, I mean, COVID was really a good relaunch point for a lot of conspiracies.
God, you're so right. You're so right. Well, yeah,
a lot sadly. Of it because people were just generally bored and wanting to do something and the internet happened to be there.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that's right. What is that time period where we all have nothing to do for a swath of time and have unfettered access to rampant opinions on the internet? Oh, and we're in a moment of national crisis and anxiety. What could go wrong, Brian? What could
possibly go wrong with any of that?
Well, let's wrap up our final one here with and this is one that I wanted to bring up specifically to, again, to demonstrate that while some of these things are you know, have come out where it's been like, okay, this may be wielded currently in its current iteration by right wing militia or, you know, organizations against like left wing side. We have one here that was leveled against George Bush specifically, and that is that 9/11 was an inside job orchestrated by the Bush administration. And I remember seeing this wonderful piece where this one professor of sociology was kind of like, this one was kind of like bucking the trend initially because I'm trying to say it as articulately as he put it, but like you actually had the perfect villain for this, right? Osama bin Laden, orchestrator of the attacks. He is a brown Muslim outsider. He is like the perfect traditional other. And yet we spun on George Bush to blame for this one, which is also kind of like a different variation on what it means that government, the fear of government and power, can override sometimes even the traditional other as a scapegoat.
That's true. I never really thought of it that way.
Right, like it wouldn't be the natural way you would think about this. Like we had a very clear choice of where we could have just demonized, and we kind of swung the other way nationally, right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, kind of like you were saying, you know, unfortunately we're hitting towards the top here, but my God, there's so many more.
I know. Well, just for those, and I, you know, we don't have to really explain to anyone what that conspiracy is. The whole earth knows about that one, right? But let's even just talk about a few kind of like the greatest hits within it, because I know that you are very well versed on this too. Let's just call out very quickly for those, yet again, our friends at Popular Mechanics and Skeptics have all like done numerous rebuttals of all of these. But the one cited from the Teen Vogue one is number one, that jet fuel cannot melt steel beams. Brian, how do you explain that?
Exactly. You know, hats off to National Geographic because it is probably
yes!
one of the best explanations of that I have ever seen. And regardless of how much you actually prove to people, once it's in their mind, you cannot break it.
That's right. And it's such a semantic parsing of, you know, parsing of hairs over just the nomenclature surrounding that. It's like, yes, okay. Yes, jet fuel itself cannot melt steel beams. It burns right around 1500 degrees Fahrenheit and steel melts at right around 2500. But do you realize that steel beams and steel begins to weaken at a mere 600 degrees Fahrenheit?
Well, and then you have to throw in the nanothermite.
That's right. And the sheer weight of the top portion of that North Tower above the weakened steel beams, which is like, what? I think they said it was almost near the Titanic in weight above that weakened position, which is like approximately like 46,000 tons. So physics is the answer, basically, what we have here. For.
No, I agree. It's just, there's just so many conspiracies to look at like that. I mean, one of the ones that you very lightly covered on it is, for some reason, you know, you brought up JFK, the assassination conspiracy. Well, now we have multiple Kennedys, they're coming back from.
Oh, they're back. That's right. And yeah, crossing political lines. And this is where, okay, this, Brian, I think is a marvel. So glad you brought that up because, yeah, this is where I think we're seeing something radically different because even from that old dichotomy of like right blaming left, left blaming right, that whole QAnon Kennedy thing of just like this reincarnation that he went underground and is now coming back to purge a government, it is a new wing of like an anti- inherent political populism in conspiracy, right? This transcends both parties. He's an enemy of both.
Well, and that's it is really interesting looking at it that way, because like you say, both sides in one way or another believe it. I mean, I know where we trace back the current origin of it, but that really doesn't seem to matter.
Oh, well, it's depressing as it is, folks. Again, our better, cooler people than us at Popular Mechanics, National Geographic, as Brian referenced, Skeptical Inquirer, all these places have debunked this so many times. So we'll just say this very quickly for you. You know, yes, steel weakens and the sheer weight, it's physics. Does it look like a demolition when you see it? Sure, but we proved in modeling that the dispersion of fuel and weight, buildings can fall vertically. We know that happened.
You know, to add one to that that I think not a lot of people are familiar with is the controlled demolition of, I believe it was Building 7 that everybody claimed.
Yeah, WTC 7. Yes.
There was a, I'm going to say rogue comedian, who, when that story first broke, he went on and took the video and actually animated explosives running down the side of the building and posted it just to show that people would believe it. And it took off like wildfire.
Oh, God, that's so horrible. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, he accidentally fed that way more than it really should have been. But it really was kind of, you know, an unfortunate but very good experiment, because it did show that these people will believe anything as long as they have just a little bit of what they believe is proof.
Right. Well, and reinforces that worldview that they have. Right. So, yeah, again, basically apply Occam's razor here. We always encourage you on this podcast, shave with Occam's razor. It's, you know, all of these things have been well refuted, not even worth mentioning, but you can go out and find all of those. Brian, as we close it, we're coming up here on our hour. What we like to at least leave with some hope. We've covered just a smattering, and we truly mean this, a small smattering of this immense topic. What are some paths forward? What can our listeners do? We actually, you know, we have shout outs to, you know, we were even able to meet when we were on sabbatical at these various events, and shout out to those, you know who you are, that we've run into out on the road and come up and thanked us for the podcast. And it's always lovely when we meet fans of the show out there. But, you know, one of the things they mentioned to us too is, you know, we have relatives or neighbors or loved ones who, you know, we listen to your show and love it, but what can we take away from this? What tools can we put in our arsenal to maybe help those people that won't listen to our show, but maybe what are some tactics that we can do in the fight to try to help steer this back, right? If a virus exists out there for conspiracy, how can we be the antibodies to help fight this?
Well, and I think, unfortunately, the wrong answer that everybody uses is trying to fight them and fight them with logic.
Exactly.
Because that will not work. Well, it should work.
We know it doesn't. It's been proven it doesn't. It has the opposite effect.
Exactly. We know it won't work, so we have to find some other way. And I think by the use of very subtle examples, and in the words of the great sage Patrick Swayze, be nice.
I love that. Also with a Red Dawn reference. These are the dots we connect for you, listeners.
But they're there.
Oh my God. No, I think you're absolutely correct in that, right? It's just how we approach that. One thing that I ran into is, you know, because we always, you know, try to do shout outs when we can to those various allies in the fight, the fellow travelers out there trying to do the right thing. In terms of rationalism, University of Chicago political science professor Eric Oliver really kind of delved into work in kind of this beautiful proposal that he has that, you know, the patterns of thought really of Americans or anyone around the world in systems can be kind of, you know, divided between those who are rational and those who use intuition as a guiding force, kind of like how we choose to see the world and then form our opinions and reactions to it. And one of his assertions is that, you know, as we are more polarized than ever with our right and left dichotomy, instead of trying to fight it from a right or left political perspective, maybe trying to gently nudge or to try to, you know, shift people between the gut, the intuitionist mindset toward a more rational one. Because they showed, he shows in his research, Brian, that both sides, people who are now, you know, believe in intuition first and those who believe in rationality first, can both have demonstrated a belief in conspiracy, but their approaches and how you can kind of be talked down from them are far more effective from those who adopt a rationalist mindset.
Absolutely.
So I think that's a good one that we do. And I, Brian, as Brian said, exactly right, especially in this time of political polarization, sitting down, being nice, talking to people, coming from a place of acceptance like this podcast was always originally created for, which is to examine not just what it is, but maybe why we're prone, showing that understanding. I think that's half the battle, right? If we can demonstrate and say, I truly kind of get, I can see why historically, evolutionarily, psychologically, we have come to this place. How can we break bread together and really try to, you know, to examine it again from a rational and skeptical perspective? And education, right? I think another big one affecting the country, lastly, is just sheer political ignorance, the lack of awareness this country has of political issues everywhere around the world has on political issues perpetuates this belief, right? That allows voters, the most dangerous thing we can do in a functioning, healthy democracy is to allow people to latch on to political ignorance and apathy. So, you know, we really need to reintroduce that sort of antidote to political ignorance and that will to try to just, you know, have apathy about it. Engagement is what we're saying. Be nice, the Patrick Swayze model, and engage and shave with Occam's razor whenever you can. Brian, yeah, thank you for this amazing episode. Thank you for getting back in the studio again. It's been a pleasure for us to talk, and we are excited that we are going to steamroll ahead. We don't have any major points of diversion planned, so I'm just looking forward to all these weeks and months ahead of us jumping into more rabbit holes. And speaking of, what have you pulled out for us out of our hats of many conspiracies for us to tackle next episode?
You know, we keep promising different ones and then all of a sudden we end up on some tangent on something else.
Well, the world compels us, right? We're always pulled back into it.
Listen, point, we were talking about it tonight. But maybe we should go back to our conversation of CERN.
I would love that. And I think that's, yes, that would be amazing. Great choice.
Yeah.
And for our listeners, just really very quickly, what is just a flash of what that conspiracy is?
It's a government funded, go figure.
Good segue.
By conspiracy, way that the collective governments can either control us, cause us to become some sort of weird devil worshiping society, or possibly open a wormhole and kill all of us.
An alternate universe, in fact, Brian.
It's true. Sorry, wormhole, black hole, some sort of a hole.
I love this. And especially like within, you know, the idea of multiverses, even within popular culture and their popularity, this has become a hot topic again. We know, listeners, you come for the sexiness of Brian and Jack, but we're going to keep you here to discuss particle accelerators next episode. And we thank you for joining us, Brian. Thank you for being a part, man. Thank you for being my partner in this fight and for envisioning this original podcast. I'm so glad you did and for having me be a part of it with you. And there's nobody else I like being in the rabbit hole with, doing the good fight with, than you. And look forward to seeing you again next episode. But in the meantime, where can we find your book? Let's talk that as ending on a hopeful note. Where can we go out and find this amazing book?
You can find it at the publisher's website at polymathpress.com or anywhere you buy books, you'll be able to find it or at least request it from them. And it's called The Case Files of the Rocky Mountain Paranormal Research Society, Volume 1.
marvelous. Go out there and find it. Listeners, if you love this show too, do us a favor, please. It's not enough that you just get to enjoy this on your own or that we get to take the pleasure out of making it. Like we mentioned, we need to fight a virus with our own virus, and that is by transmitting and spreading this podcast. So if you or someone you love, you think might love this podcast as much as you do, please like us, first of all. It helps us in our algorithm searches, and be sure to share it, write a review, and just pass this along. It's important for us to infect those allies one by one until we can start winning the good fight, so that hopefully one day can happen, Brian, where we don't have to make this podcast anymore. And we can then talk about cool horror movies all day. So thank you again, buddy. Thank you to our listeners. We will catch you next episode. Thank you for listening.